This conference will now be recorded.
Well, welcome everybody to the first Air Force Reserve Flight Chief Teleseminar. And today we're going to be discussing the handling recruiter performance issues. But I'm going to start off with a few of the housekeeping items. To make this very successful, your comments and questions are going to be highly encouraged. We'll be calling on you quite a bit. So when you do speak, please just identify yourself so we know who we're talking to. But again, it's going to be most effective with your participation. If you have recorded music when you put your phone on hold, please don't put it on hold. You can mute and unmute your phone by pressing star 2. We're not going to do a roll call. What I'll need you to do is, after the call, just send me an email at gbarnes, G-B-A-R-N-E-S, at thebrooksgroup.com, or you can reply to my reminder that the lines were open. Either way works for me. But please make sure you include the 10-digit number of the phone you're calling in from, because our system shows me what numbers are logged in, and I can match them up that way and make sure you get credit for attendance today. And we are proud to have with us today and welcome Mr. Kevin Reinert from Greensboro, North Carolina, who will be co-hosting today's teleseminar with me. And for those of you that don't know, this is Glenn Barnes with the Brooks Group calling from wonderful, hot, humid Cochran, Georgia. So at this time, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Reinert and welcome Mr. Reinert.
Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Barnes. And I had a slight technical difficulty, and I lost contact for a moment. Were you able to hit the record button?
Yes.
Okay, great. Again, I lost the contact there. Apologize for that, everybody. And good morning, and welcome to our teleseminar today, Handling Recruiter Performance Issues. You know, one of the greatest challenges faced by leaders and managers in dealing with recruiter performance issues is that the fact that there are many types of issues that you're going to encounter. And for as many issues as you're going to run into, there are that many reasons for those issues developing in the first place. In today's program, we're going to be looking at how we handle these problems. We'll be discussing setting expectations, measurements, identifying the types of problems, and addressing the various problems that you may encounter as a leader. You know, one of your primary responsibilities is to develop successful recruiters and NCOs. And this can only be done through interaction with your people. As Abraham Lincoln once said, "My great concern is not whether you have failed, but whether you are content with your failure." As such, we cannot let our recruiters be content with failure. And you know, it all begins with clear expectations. And Mr. Barnes, I think we've got some good information to talk about here, because expectations really start with orientation.
And that's right. The Air Force Reserve and the recruiting service has an established 5-day initial task training, which they call their orientation program. And I want to turn it out immediately to the recruiters out there. As part of the orientation program, I mean, there's the setup, things like that. But when you're establishing the expectations for recruiters coming in, what are some of the things that you cover with recruiters as far as the specific expectations of them? And again, I'm going to turn it out to the audience out there and give us some ideas of some of the expectations you put out immediately for your recruiters.
Hey, how you doing, Mr. Barnes? This is Sergeant Brown calling from ERS Training Shop. Some of the expectations that are put out or come through are what we call a 5-day tracker. And within the 5-day tracker, when a recruiter PCS is on station, or we get a new recruiter and from recruiting school, basically the flight chief supervisor will sit down within those 5 days and cover logistics, administrative functions, but will also cover what their expectations are as a leader to them as a subordinate. So in the first 5 days of being arriving on station, the flight chief / supervisor is going to explain to them, here's the expectations behind performance in their first 5 days. That's outside of their initial expectation feedback. That's within the recruiting 5-day tracker system.
Okay. All right. And what are some of the specific expectations from an OL or from a operating location or a flight level that you are giving to your recruiters. I'd like to hear some of the different things specific to flight chiefs out there, what some of your expectations are for your recruiters. What are some of the specifics?
This is Callahan at Eglin. You know, you tell them what uniforms to wear, what times they need to be at work, at a minimum expectations, you know, not to put enough fuel in the car, what to report to. I mean, the list goes on and on. Every flight chief's got different.
Okay. All right. Anybody else? All right. And one thing that I did not notice, I had a copy of the initial, the new recruiter 5-day initial task training. One thing I didn't notice in there, and I'm wondering if any of the flight chiefs use it, is do you share your assessments with your recruiters and look at your recruiters' assessments and use that as part of their orientation process?
This is Sergeant Kirk here at Scott.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I initially arrived here as a flight chief, I shared my assessment with each of my recruiters, as well as sat down with each one of them and kind of had them circle some of the items that they felt was most important to them as far as the do's and don'ts of communication and ways to manage them. So it kind of opened up conversation as to how to lead and how to train these individuals, how to communicate with them. So,
okay, very good. Yeah, I would highly suggest that's something you do, especially, you're right, is on the two of the areas, especially with the new recruiter, would be the how to communicate with them, how they communicate with you. And the other thing I would always recommend looking at is your sense of urgency and their sense of urgency. It's a totally different teleseminar we do, but one of the greatest conflicts with supervisors and the people that work for them is that sense of urgency. If you have a high sense of urgency, they have a low sense of urgency, or vice versa, there can be a lot of conflict there. So that's another thing in that assessment I really would encourage you to look at. And so you can discuss that and set those expectations depending on where those sense of urgencies are. But again, that orientation, very important to start off with the clear expectations. And another aspect of that is the accountability. And Mr. Reiner, what are we talking about with the accountability?
Well, the big question is there, do you make it clear to your recruiters exactly what they have to do? And we'll talk about the measurements of those in just a few minutes. But, you know, accountability by definition is holding people, you know, to make sure they do what they are supposed to do. And accountability goes both ways. For you as a flight chief, you have to be accountable to your folks as well. In other words, if you promise you're going to provide certain resources or provide assistance in certain areas, you have to live up to that expectation as well. And of course, we know that when you set expectations, you've got to inspect what you expect. Otherwise, people after a while are going to say, you know what, the boss is asking me to do things that, you know, obviously they're not that important because he or she never comes around to check on them. So make sure that when you're asking your folks to do certain things, that you follow up and you ask about those things so that people know that they are important. And with that goes the responsibility of the flight chief, Mr. Barnes, to provide tight feedback.
Yeah, and on that initial feedback, especially when they're coming in, these are just some considerations. You know, are you doing that over the phone or in person? Is it in your office or is it in their office? You know, are you being open and honest feedback? And is it two-way or one-way? And those are all key questions to consider for that initial feedback, trying to get that whole getting them comfortable, knowledgeable, things like that. I would hope that that initial feedback is done in person. And ideally, it'll be done in their office for that initial feedback. Again, getting them settled in, comfortable, and again, you know, asking for their input during that feedback to make it a two-way conversation. So again, that initial feedback is very important, and of course, along with that goes the documentation. And as we mentioned earlier, when Mr. Reiner was talking about accountability, is, you know, you have to be able to measure it. And, you know, those expectations have a centerpiece, and they're called metrics. And, Mr. Reiner, can you discuss the two different types that we really look at in here?
Right. There are two different types of measurements. There's what we call in-process and end-process measurements. And I'm going to go right to our audience on this one. Can somebody give me an example of activities that are measured, that they measure, that are as part of the process that lead to those accessions that we're looking for? What are some of the key numbers you're looking at on a weekly, monthly, or, you know, quarterly basis? What are some things you're looking for?
This is Sergeant Brown again. Hello?
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Sergeant Brown again. The one thing that can be tracked and measured that I would look at would basically be lead generation, prospecting, and how many actually leads that the recruiter is getting, and are they accountable for the leads and what are they doing with them? So if I meet somebody on Thursday, I get a lead. I'm looking at processing time. Okay, how long did it take you to get them in the office? Okay, once they got in the office, I'm going to be looking at, okay, what's your interview skills when you did impact? What was the outcome of your impact? Are they going to the MEPS? Are they not going to the MEPS? Is there any concerns? So I would start with the leads. How many leads are you generating, and what you do, and what are you doing with those leads?
I like that approach, Sergeant Brown. I think you're right on target. It starts with the lead generation. In other words, if a recruiter gets 10 leads, you know, first of all, where are those leads from? And what's more important, Mr. Barnes, you've got some great data on this. Could you talk to our audience briefly about the difference between the self-generated lead versus the national lead?
Yeah, and I'm sure the numbers are still consistent. When I was chief of advertising, I used to really track this. And what we found out was in the reserve recruiting that recruiter-generated leads actually assess at right about a 50% rate. And on active duty recruiting, from contacting their people, found out that on active duty, recruiter-generated leads actually assess at about 70%. Now, does anyone out there want to venture a guess at what percentage of national leads ever actually assess? Somebody throw a number out there.
10%. This is Chief Schechsner.
10%. All right. Anybody else? Okay. This is across all components, all services. In other words, active, Guard, Reserve, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. National leads assess at less than 1% across the board. So hopefully that measuring the recruiter-generated leads is really something that you do look at, because are there some areas that may be able to survive on national leads? Maybe. But to be successful and be the most effective, it's going to be those recruiter-generated leads. And, you know, there's some other in-process measurements. Anyone else have any ideas? You know, Sergeant Brown gave us a very good list, but are there some other things you're looking at?
Mr. Callahan, again, I always look at the big five. I like knowing their processing times. I like knowing lead contact, lead, you know, then from how long it takes to the MEPS to actually enlist. And I track that myself. That way we can see if there's a breakdown and where it's at. It helps me better identify the problems.
Excellent. Mr. Reiner? Uh-oh, did we lose Mr. Reiner? Okay. Then hopefully Mr. Reiner will be back with us in just a second. Might have technical difficulties again.
I'm back online. Apologize, the phone went dead.
Okay. Yeah, we had just finished up talking about, we got some more ideas on the in-process measurements, but there's also another type.
Yeah, and that's your in-process, and those are strictly your results. You know, how many accessions did you get? And that's very important, obviously. That's what the scoreboard says at the end of the year. But if you're only doing in-process measurements, you know, when it comes September and you find out you're short on the numbers you need, it's a little too late to take action. So really take a look at your in-process measurements, and you know, you can judge your recruiter's performance against each other by the factors that Sergeant Brown talked about, things like how quickly do you, you know, turn around a lead? How quickly do you get them in the office? How quickly are they contacted? How fast do you get them through MEPS? Things like that are all very, very important. But, you know, metrics alone is not the only thing that we have to look at. There's some other things that are all part of the recruiter benchmark. Mr. Barnes, would you talk about those personal skills?
Yeah, the personal skills, you know, and what we say is that a recruiter can, for a short time, falter or fail in this area and still deliver sales. And, you know, what we mean by that is, you know, they may not be applying the personal skills, but they're still successful. And there's a couple ways that could happen. If you've got a recruiter working in an Air Force base for in-service recruiters that has lots of separatees, there's a force-shaping program going on. These people want to continue their service. They may lack the skills, but they're still successful just because of the volume. And the, like we say, sometimes recruiters put people in spite of the recruiter. And another example may be if you've got a recruiter that's in a target-rich environment, loaded with military bases, lots of leads coming in. They can be successful for a while, but what you have to watch out for as situations change, as leads dry up, as zones slow down, that's where you can start seeing a lack of the recruiter's personal skills. And again, it goes back to being able to measure what they're doing. And, you know, how many of you are familiar with the recruiter benchmark that's been established for reserve recruiting? Okay. Basically, the personal skills, there's actually 23 that are measured, but working with the Air Force Reserve Recruiting Service, different flight supervisors, the headquarters people, they established the 7 most crucial personal skills for a recruiter. Now, granted, it's been a while. We've already talked to RSOT, and at the beginning of the fiscal year, we're going to be re-looking at the benchmark. But as it exists right now, the 7 most critical skills we're looking at are self-management, personal accountability, resiliency, diplomacy and tact, interpersonal skills, teamwork, and continuous learning. And there's really the top three that I want to, you know, get you all involved in, because really the self-management not only is a benchmark for reserve for the recruiters, but across the corporate clients that we deal with at the Brooks Group, the military, self-management is one of the personal skills that is in every single benchmark. And somebody out there, what is self-management that makes it such a steady skill across all benchmarks? What are we talking about when we talk about self-management?
Hey, this is Chief Sexnider. Hey, Glenn. I think maybe you're probably just talking about what is a self-starter, an individual who can see the big picture quickly, grasp it. You don't really have to do anything but really fire and forget the weapon. They come to you with new ideas as opposed to you have to constantly go to that recruiter and pushing your ideas to them instead of them coming back to you. You don't have to follow with them on suspenses all the time. They understand that this isn't technically a 40-hour a week job. You see it in some individuals and others you don't.
You know, and you actually nailed 2 of the big things in there. One being the self-starter, the other being recognizing it's not a 40-hour week. And part of that self-management is, you know, it's contained in there. It's managing oneself. And one of the big issues in the self-management is time management. Can they manage their time? And you know, when you have new recruiters come on board, not as much from a PCS, but as new to recruiting, do any of you find that your new recruiters have great time management skills and know exactly where they should be, when they should be, and what they should be doing?
No way.
No, I don't think so, and I can tell you why. They might have had previous time management skills from another career field or another private sector job, but once they come into recruiting, they have to learn how to manage their time with our processes, and that comes with their JQS training. It's good if they do bring some time management skills because they can task prioritize and organize and do things like that. That's great, or even multitask. Some of them are good at that. But I think once they learn our processes and what's a priority for recruiting, that's the real measuring stick. Because if people have time management skills in corporate jobs, and also in other career fields. But however, when you come to recruiting, you have to learn what's a priority, what's not a priority. When can I, by use of my planning guide, and they teach you that in recruiting school. But once you get out into the field, you have to learn what's a priority, what's not a priority, what can wait, what can't wait, the whole deal. If you bring those time management skills to the table, that's great. But however, you have to learn our processes and our guidelines and our sales strategies and implement those time management skills to that.
Okay. And Mr. Reinert, there's two others that I had mentioned that if you would touch on before we move on, and that's personal accountability and resiliency. Why are those so high up in the personal skills for a recruiter?
Well, personal accountability, by nature, the definition is, do you take responsibility for your own actions? You know, how many of you have been stationed with people in this career field that it's never their fault? When it's, you know, when something goes wrong, it's the MEPS, it's the headquarters, it's, you know, an office partner, it's the applicant, but they never did anything wrong. They're always the victim. Anybody run into those kind of recruiters?
Colonel Reiner, Mr. Reiner, this is Chief Sexnider again. I'm dealing with that with a new rookie recruiter right now who just got that feedback exactly last week, which was, you know, coming to her with the data and saying, you know, this example, and yet another. And in each case, none of them were your fault. It's a difficult feedback because you're really trying to help correct them, but at the same time, not making an attack on a personal character. So dealing with it with
right.
Rookie right
and
now.
You brought up a good point there. And the thing to do is, how many of you have found that it's very difficult when you counsel somebody to talk about attitude? Has anybody found that's a real difficult subject to discuss somebody's attitude?
Yes, agreed. This is Chief George. I completely agree. It's an uncomfortable topic.
Exactly. See, it's very hard to measure attitude, but you can measure behavior. For example, if you have a person on your team who's late for work, you know, four times in the last 2 weeks, you know, if you say to that person, you got a lousy attitude about coming to work, they're going to get very defensive, and they're going to say, no, I don't. I got a good attitude. But if you consider it and say, in the last 2 weeks, you were late four times, came in 25 minutes late one day, 30 minutes the next, 10 minutes after that, they can't argue with that. So when it comes to dealing with accountability, stick to the behaviors that are associated with it. You'll find it much easier to deal with those than trying to deal with attitudes. And the third one is resiliency. This is so important because, you know, some recruiters out there, you know, when they lose an applicant, you know, when it comes time for them to ship or they back out on them, they get really bummed out. Has anybody run into that type of recruiter where, you know, they lose an applicant and they're shut down for a day or two, they can't do anything?
Yes, Chief Jordan again, yes.
Yeah, and so, you know, you have to say next. And the interesting thing about the personal skills, it's very hard for me to teach them. I can refine them a little bit, but either you have them or you don't. Either, you know, when it comes to self-management, yes, I can provide you some training on time management, but you're either going to do it or you don't. When it comes to personal accountability, either you have that skill or you don't. I can talk about how important it is, and I can refine it, but I just can't make it happen. And that's the difference between what we call the soft skills or the personal skills and job skills. I can teach you how to fill out a Form 4. I can teach you how to fill out a different, you know, piece of paper and use a computer. That's not a problem. But the personal skills are going to tell me whether or not you're going to do it. So that's why those top 7 personal skills are so important. And unfortunately, Mr. Barnes, you know, even people with good personal skills sometimes have some problems. People with poor personal skills generally have more. But we all know that when problems occur, they got to be dealt with right away, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you can't let it fester. They have to be dealt with as they occur. You know, there's a couple problems with letting them, by not addressing them, is if others on the team see it and they're not dealt with, they feel like that's becoming the acceptable behavior as well as the individual, so it can spread throughout the team. But there's a couple of things to keep in mind when you're dealing with the problems as they happen. And these are some advice, four things. Is one is make sure you have the facts. Make sure you have the whole picture. Don't confront them when you're angry. When we say immediately, if it means, you know, 2 or 3 minutes where you've got to settle yourself down, if it's that bad, don't do it when you're angry. And also, you know, there's going to be times that things happen that may be beyond your ability to handle or in your authority to handle. Make sure you identify those and consult with your leadership for advice when that happens. And do that by following the chain of command. You know, there may be times where it is extremely serious. Generally, we're talking court martial Article 15 type behavior. Yeah, definitely consult with leadership. But again, you know, you've got to deal with them as they occur. But keep in mind, have the facts, the whole picture. Don't do it while you're angry, and know where your authority level ends and what needs to be elevated. And when we talk about problems, you know, with recruiters, you know, this is all about handling performance issues. And as we know, there's going to be a lot of different types of problems. And Mr. Reiner, if you would, could you start us out on, let's talk about some of the types of problems that leaders are going to face.
Sure. The first one is the pipeline that the recruiter has. And that usually stems from not enough prospecting to ensure that you're going to have an even flow of accessions. And, you know, if you go back to the basic impact diagram, you remember that wall of apathy and resistance out there. Well, it's just not applicants or prospects that can resist. It can be the recruiter as well. If a recruiter is not feeling comfortable about getting out there in the public environment, you know, getting out into the schools, for example, that can cause a lot of hesitation and can cause a lot of problems when it comes to prospecting. Mr. Barnes, you and I were looking over the orientation form, and there seemed to be an awful lot to teach when it came to school visits within just that first week, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. And, you know, the school program, extremely important, and I'm hoping that this is in the orientation an overview of the program, but you know, hopefully there's more follow-up where they're actually being shown school visits, how to properly do it, because most of them have never done anything like that, and they may not even be aware. It's easy to say you need to do it, but I think part of that follow-up, in addition to the initial training, is that or to the initial orientation, is that actual example of, hey, this is how you do it, whether you do it or you have a recruiter that's got a really good school program. But yeah, there is a lot of information, a lot of things to cover in that first 5 days.
Mm-hmm. You know, a second type of problem is the conversion. You know, the recruiter has people in the pipeline, but they're not advancing the sale. And I'll open it up to the audience here. How many of you have noticed that some recruiters on your team are able to convert a high percentage of people, and then maybe some recruiters, they don't seem to have as high a conversion rate? Anybody notice that with any of their team members?
I guess, Mr. Ryan, I'm going to tell you this right quick. I keep jumping in, but I think a lot of times recruiters have a pipeline, or their buckets are top to bottom full, and it gives them a false sense of security that they're going to make goal without even really looking at moving, like you just said, moving them through the system and getting them across the finish line. I think they see a lot of applicants in their bucket, and their bucket is tall, and they think this diverts them from prospecting, and they're like, well, I'm going to make goal, Sean Brown, because look it, I have all these applicants. But yet you have not moved them through the process in a timely manner. And I think that stalls out a lot of ISRs stalls out. It stalls out maybe some HPOA folks, which I know their process is a little bit longer than us line guys. But it just seeing all those applicants all the time sometimes gives them that false insecurity that they're going to cross the line.
Mm-hmm. I think it's very valuable when you're running a team to compare your performers and see what the average processing time is and why some people are able to get people through the pipeline faster than others. And, of course, there's the anomalies. You know, sometimes an applicant has something pop up. But by and large, you know, throw out a couple at the fast ones, throw out a couple of slow ones and see what the average time is overall and compare recruiters across the board. And, of course, another problem is simply the volume. You know, if a recruiter is not producing enough accessions or maybe too many applicants are requiring waivers, that could be an indication of a problem. And along with that, Mr. Barnes, is you know, when we get people that are willing to say yes and join the Air Force Reserve, where we put them is just as important for a recruiter.
Yeah, and if we know, I still hear it in coaching calls with flight chiefs, with recruiters. We know that there's issues at locations about positions. But, you know, sometimes by watching the recruiters, seeing how they're going about their impact process, things like that, you may be able to alleviate recruiters not filling critical AFSCs and filling in overages instead of the critical vacancies. And one of the ways that you can identify that is through JCAs, is if you see them get early on selling jobs or letting the applicant or the lead take control of the situation and turn it to jobs. That's normally an indication where they get into problems of working overages instead of selling the value of the Air Force Reserve. They get so hung up on jobs. And Mr. Reinert had a great example that he uses in class. I've heard him. And Mr. Reinert, why don't you ask one of our people out there about their favorite sport?
Yeah, anybody here a baseball fan?
Not at all.
No.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you play baseball?
I did not, but I love it. Love to watch.
Okay, what's your favorite team?
The Red Sox.
The Red Sox. Okay. Well, you got a problem right there, all right? But if you play for the Red Sox, if you could play, what position would you want to play for the Red Sox?
Shortstop.
Okay, you want to play shortstop for the Red Sox. Now, you're in their minor league system, and you're working your way up, and the general manager from the Red Sox calls up and says, you know what, we've had some injuries up here at the big club, and I've got to bring up another ball player. I've already got a shortstop, a good one, but our second baseman is hurt. Would you come to the major leagues and play second base or stay in the minor leagues and play shortstop?
Absolutely.
Come up to the major leagues?
Yeah, I'm coming up. I'm playing second base.
Okay, but wait a minute. You wanted that job as shortstop, so why are you willing to accept that job at second base?
Because it gives me an opportunity to play in the majors, and, you know, if I can play shortstop, I'm pretty sure I can manage second base.
All right. In other words, your dream is to get to the big club, right?
That's right.
We want everybody's dream to be in the Air Force Reserve, and what job they have is far less important. And so if the recruiter is out there selling the value of the Air Force Reserve, what job they do is far less important because they want to get to the big club. They want to live that dream and get the benefits that are associated with being up there. So I think that's very, very important that when it comes to selling jobs, that recruiters continue to sell the value of the Air Force Reserve and not get job locked. And of course, in dealing with applicants, Mr. Barnes, how important is service?
Yeah, and that's another one that sometimes as leaders, you may not be as much in the loop unless you're really involved with the MPF or the student training flight. And some of the things that really have to be looked at is abnormally high number of applicant complaints, high washout rates at basic training. You know, those can be signs of serious, serious performance issues on the recruiter. But there's also part of the relationships that can be problematic as well that really have to be watched. And there's a few of those, a couple of those. And, Mr. Reiner, could you start over on those when we're talking about relationships?
Sure. You know, it's important that we build good relationships within our units, you know, and that. But sometimes recruiters can really mess things up with the MPF, with the gaining units, or other recruiters. Has anybody out there seen an example maybe where a recruiter kind of messed things up for you over at the MPF or at the MEPS, kind of got some people upset over there? Anybody had that happen?
Yeah, this is Sergeant Hudson over at Patrick. Even some simple stuff like packages that are incomplete or from other recruiters or something like that, when it goes over to the MPF, can create a little turmoil for the other local recruiters.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it's important that you know, you watch the members of your team to making sure that they're keeping good relationships within those internal customers. And then there's the external side. You know, has the recruiter built up, you know, some problems with educators, with business leaders or media outlets? You know, the blue suit generally doesn't have a problem, but I'll bet you in all your years out there, you've had a school or two where a counselor has told you, we've had problems with recruiters out there. And hopefully it's none of ours, but occasionally it can be. I've seen it happen where, you know, recruiters said something to somebody and they offended somebody in a classroom or in a meeting. And the next thing you know, the school is saying, we really don't want you out here anymore. So, you know, look for those kind of problems. And along with that goes the integrity issue. You know, sometimes recruiters push very, very hard, especially the highly competitive ones. And sometimes they want to win so bad that maybe they cut some corners. Maybe they've misled some applicants, or maybe they're pencil whipping some paperwork or behavior out there. We've seen it over the years. Mr. Barnes, as a first sergeant, you have seen it. You have had to deal with it. And unfortunately, personal problems that go along because we're dealing with people.
Yeah, you know, and some of the personal problems, you know, and I know as leaders, especially with your high-producing recruiters, and, you know, for years we've talked about the high maintenance, high production, what's your level of acceptance, things like that. But, you know, there are personal problems that as a leader, as a supervisor, that you've got to be aware of and be willing to address. You know, and some of those may be the physical appearance. You may find people starting to burn out, marital problems, financial problems, health problems. But the thing to keep in mind is that, you know, the Air Force has got many support agencies to help with a lot of these problems. But in some of these, you really need to make sure to use your chain of command, use your first sergeant, use your superintendent commander, especially when you're seeking assistance from the support agencies. Again, we want to make sure the person's taken care of, but it can't be the personal problems can't be an excuse for the behavior. So it still has to be addressed. And while, you know, we've just listed and discussed quite a few of the various problems you're going to face, or that you already are facing from the discussions. But, you know, there's, you know, basically there's really three rules that apply when you are addressing or handling these issues. And, Mr. Ryan, would you cover the three basic rules when you're dealing with any problem?
Sure. First, the recruiters have to understand the level of responsibility and authority they have. And I'll quickly open this up. Can you give different recruiters on your team different levels of authority?
Yes.
Yeah, how come?
Because some are more capable of accepting the challenge and the increased authority versus others.
Absolutely, yes. You know, not everybody's the same. And one of the third rule, and I'll actually skip to that one, is that recruiters must be treated fairly, but you don't have to treat them all the same. You know, people have earned certain rights and privileges based on their past performance. So again, treat everybody fairly, but you don't have to necessarily treat everybody the same. And the third thing is that recruiters must know the consequences of poor performance or errors. And I once heard a great statement where somebody said, mistakes I can handle, it's incompetence that bothers me. And what I mean by that is, you know, recruiters can make mistakes of commission, where, you know, they try to do something new and it doesn't work out. That's not a problem. That's not poor performance. Okay, repeating the same error over and over again, that's incompetence and poor performance. But when somebody tries something new, they're going to make some mistakes, that's okay. The question is, did they learn from that? And as supervisors, we can ask people when they do something wrong, you know, why did you do that? What was your reasoning behind it? You know, what did you learn from this that you don't make that same mistake again? But again, people very often will make some mistakes. It's okay as long as they've learned from these. And that's why it's very, very important to go along with the rules, is that we have systems or processes in place, Mr. Barnes. And would you start talking about those for us?
Yeah, we've got about 15 minutes left. And real quickly, we want to go over, we've got 9 identified systems or processes in place to identify different problems. The first one is your forecasting system or process. And this goes back to what we were talking about before, measurements. Are your recruiters making realistic forecasts for monthly, quarterly, annual sessions? Are they updating their plans? Do they even have a plan? I'm sure that everybody has their recruiters do the strategic plan Parthenons. Are they using them? Are they updating them? Number 2 is the linked sequential sales system. And we ask there, are your recruiters actually using Impact or are they winging it? And then the follow-up question to that is, especially for recruiters that are successful, do you let them wing it if they're making their goal? That's just some considerations to have about the Impact selling system. Make sure they're using it. They're using it properly. Mr. Reinhart, there's a very interesting statistic about the linked sequential sales system and success. Can you run that number by us?
Yes, if a recruiter uses a linked sequential sales system, in the case of the Air Force Reserve, it's Impact, with a qualified lead, let me stress, with a qualified lead, not just anybody who walks in the door or a national lead, but with a qualified lead, statistics say they have a better than 90% chance of being successful, of gaining the accession. However, if they fall back to winging it, even with a qualified lead, their chances of success run around 43%. So basically, you have a twice as good a chance by using the sales model. And sometimes recruiters out there say, well, you know, I'm successful. I don't have to do this or do that. But what happens when they become managers out there? If they don't apply the system on a regular basis, they're not going to be able to work with recruiters out there that are struggling, because the Impact system is what has been issued to the Air Force Reserve. And it's very important that they continue to use it, because that is the weapon of choice, so to speak, for the Air Force Reserve. What about the pipeline management system, Mr. Barnes? What about
The third one, the pipeline management system, is how are the recruiters doing their prospecting? How are you measuring what they're doing? Are you actually going out with them, seeing how they prospect? And are they using the Parthenons to prospect? And the question we asked there is, if you went to their office, could they produce the Parthenon and explain them? And I know on the phone line, there's a couple of old-timers, not quite as old-timer as me, but were around when Impact first came out. And, you know, the big thing was, hey, you do your Parthenons for each target segment. And one of the first things I saw as a lead recruiter at that time, I went to an office, and the recruiter, I asked him, I said, well, how's your Parthenons? He says, oh, they're great. He says, right here they are. And he pointed to them on the wall. He had 3 Parthenons in frames hanging on the wall. Does anybody see a problem with that, being in a frame hanging on the wall?
Not subject to change.
Kind of hard to change it if it's not
exactly.
It's a living, working document. It's a living, breathing document.
Thank you. Somebody copied my words I used to always use when I taught Parthenons. Did you ever happen to be in one of my classes?
No, Pete Barnes. I work with you forever, so that's all I'm going to say. And I was there in 1999. I know.
Yeah, that Parthenon is a living, breathing document. It should be ugly. It should be marked up, scratched out, wrinkled. I didn't care if it had coffee spill stains on it. It is a working document. So, again, that's all part of that pipeline management system. And then there's 3 more. Mr. Reiner, would you want to cover the next 3, please?
Sure, and that's your field coaching system. You know, are you conducting joint call coaching audits out there on a regular basis? You know, Obviously, with new recruiters out there, it should be very often. With experienced folks, not nearly as often, but it's still a good idea to make sure they're staying sharp. You know, even the best athletes have a coach that makes sure they're doing things so that they don't fall into slumps out there. And so, you know, be coaching all of your people all the time. Even successful recruiters like to know that somebody is looking out for them. And make sure when you do grade those joint call audits that you do it objectively. We see, you know, very often EPRs get inflated. Well, don't let the joint call audit scores get inflated. 3 is a good score, you know, for somebody. They're doing their job. They're doing a little bit better, a 4. And if you're giving them all 5s, let me tell you, if they deserve all 5s, let Mr. Barnes know, because we'll put you in for a job at the Brooks Group. So remember that. Your job also is to conduct meaningful training meetings. You know, do your sales training meetings include sales training, okay? You'd be amazed sometimes when we talk to people how very little sales training goes on at a sales training meeting. That includes role-playing. And a word of advice on the role-playing is that keep it serious. A lot of times when groups out there do role-playing, people get silly. And that's a defense mechanism. That's so, we don't embarrass the person who's playing the part of the recruiter. We'll get funny and go from there. Don't do it. Keep it as realistic as possible. You know, train like you're going to fight. And do more than just cover policy at meetings. Get there and practice. Practice, practice, practice. That's how you're going to get better. And when it comes time to writing those performance reviews, make sure they're an accurate depiction, not a cookie cutter. You know, somebody ought to be able to show somebody their EPR if they're a top performer and be really, really proud of it, because it's got a lot of specifics in there. And don't just give everybody the top rating, only the ones who really deserve it. And let me just ask this. What criteria do you use for somebody getting top ratings on an EPR? What are some things that you consider before you give somebody a 5?
This is Chief Chuck Snyder. Customization of the system is what I look for, personalized, and even change from applicant to applicant makes it even better. Where they may mix up their bonding statements of intention, they make it more personalized. They actually kind of have judged the cell of the individual, you know, whether they're a doer, talker, pacer, controller. That's what I look for as far as getting close to the 5, sir.
All right. Okay, that's on the joint call audit. But what about on EPRs, Chief? How do you decide who gets the 5 out there? What constitutes somebody really being a top performer?
Well,
sir, this is Sergeant Hudson over at Patrick. I like to use the new feedback form that we've gone to with the Air Force, because when you sit down and talk with the recruiter, you can kind of really, it really kind of lays down what a 5 individual is. Like, clearly, you know, is leading the way. And a lot of times when you're vocalizing that with the recruiter and just talking to him and reading those statements out loud, you can ask them, hey, do you feel like you're this type of person? And a lot of times you get honest feedback where they say, no, that really doesn't sound like me. So I thought that was valuable.
I think that's a great approach. You know, ask people, what do you think you've done to deserve, you know, your rating, so that they can justify it? Because I see too many examples of supervisors just giving everybody the top ratings across the board. And when it comes time for promotion, you know, it's really difficult to select when boards only have those scores to look at. So make sure that you recommend people. Did somebody have something they wanted to add?
I would say with that, Colonel, is whatever I find that I have just too many things to put in an EPR, I know I'm probably getting close to my top person. When I just don't have enough room on the EPR itself to fit in all the bullets that I have, I know I'm dealing with my top.
Right.
When I'm struggling to find items, that's when I know I'm not dealing with, or either I haven't vectored that person correctly.
Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with asking your folks for those bullets. Let me know what you have done, what you consider your strengths are out there. Because obviously, as supervisors, we're busy. We don't see everything everybody does. And it is important that people take the time to toot their own horn, so to speak, when they're doing good things out there. But, of course, there's some things like flow trend analysis that are very, very important, Mr. Barnes. So talk about those next three items.
Yeah, the next three systems or processes, the first one deals with the flow trend analysis. That was brought up earlier by a couple different people. And are you tracking the recruiter activity? Are the activities you're tracking worth tracking? Are the activities they're doing worth doing? And are you looking at the end process or only the end end process data. Again, that end process is probably more critical because you can look at that in the flow trend and get a good picture of what that end is going to look like. And also, it's, you know, part of identifying and correcting the trends that you're seeing, so it's properly using the flow trend analysis. The last two, one is the formal and informal reward system. And what we're talking about that is the wing, squadron, recruiting service level competitions. Do the recruiters understand what they have to do to compete? And are you putting them, you know, do the recruiters have input into the informal reward systems? A lot of it comes down from headquarters, but if you're doing things locally, do you get their input? Because as we all know, what motivates each individual is going to vary by individual. You know, we like to think all recruiters are highly competitive, but the truth is they're not. They're going to do the job, they're going to do it well, but they don't really care about the competition. You know, you just have to really analyze what's going to work best for your people when you're talking about that formal and informal reward system. Not everybody wants days off because they figure if they're taking a day off, that's a day of production they're losing. So as a supervisor leader, it's important to be looking at their assessment, talking to them, find out what drives them, what motivates them. And then finally, we don't like to use it, but it is mandatory. And, you know, it's the sanction system. And do you have a process to record the unsatisfactory performance and behavior? And are you actually documenting the problems and keeping records? And most importantly, are you following the appropriate Air Force instructions when doing so? Again, if it's really significant, you may have to flow it up through the superintendent, the first sergeant. But, again, you have to have that sanction system. The recruiters have to understand it. You have to execute it fairly. But, again, it's an important system. So, again, those are nine of the systems that you really need to have in place where you can effectively handle recruiter performance issues, whether it's personal, behavioral, production. Those are all things that, as a leader and supervisor, that you do have to handle, and that's all performance issues. And then what we want to do is, Mr. Reiner, we've got about 4 minutes left here, and we've got some closing thoughts, and these are just some general ideas. If you would, Mr. Reiner, would you go over those with us real quickly, please?
Sure. Some of these are common sense, but as we all know, common sense is not always common. So, you know, number one, praise publicly, chastise privately. That's a given. That's management 101 out there. But in any situation... In any situation, get to the truth. You know, you may have somebody making a complaint out there, and don't just take it at face value. Do your investigation. Never stop coaching. The late Mr. Brooks, you know, his name was Coach because he was a college football coach and very successful in that, very successful in business. And he always said the key was getting out there with his sales force on a regular basis, watching them how they're doing, giving them feedback. So never, never stop coaching. Even when somebody is successful out there, winning teams still get coached every day. And I alluded to this already. Understand that what you see may not be the whole story. You know, sometimes, you know, somebody may say something about one of your folks out there and it sounds bad, but there's two sides to every situation. So learn to sort things out. You know, and the truth is you can't manage from behind a desk. A lot of times we have nice offices and we got lots of paperwork and we can always sit there and do some sort of paperwork or go to a meeting. But the truth is you will do yourself and your team a lot more good if you get out there from behind the desk and find out what they're doing out there, getting in the trenches with them. That's leadership by example. And some of you may have found this, and this one is very important. Don't expect to be loved. You know, you can be friendly with the members of your team, but if you are really close friends with the members of your team, you may lose your objectivity. So remember, you know, you can't have everybody like you at any given time. In fact, maybe the best advice I ever got in my career was a boss who told me that 20% of your people aren't upset at you at one time or another, you're probably not doing your job. And that doesn't mean they want to kill you. That doesn't mean they hate you. They may be disagreeing with something you're doing out there, and that's okay because that means you're doing things. And sometimes you're going to have to decide, you know, if you're better off with or without a certain member of your team. If they're keeping you awake at night and yet they're sleeping and they're not performing well and you're the one who's upset and worried, you ought to do something about that. So make sure that, you know, you're not keeping hold of people just because you feel sorry for them. They have a job to do out there. And lastly, manage tightly. That is not micromanaging. Okay, make sure your folks are doing what they're supposed to do. Micromanaging is being over their shoulder every minute of the day, you know, where they can't do anything without asking you permission. But it's okay to check up on people, find out how things are going. You know, stop by, even without an appointment, as they say, and find out what's happening out there. So those are just some final thoughts. And Mr. Barnes, I'll let you things wrap it up. You just got a couple minutes.
All right. First of all, please remember to send me an email or reply to my email that when I said that the lines were open and include the phone number you called in from, so that way I can make sure you get credit for the call here. And on behalf of myself, Mr. Reiner at the Brooks Group, we appreciate your participation today. Hopefully you found some value. You got a couple takeaways. What we will also do is we will post the recording of the call on the brooksafrc.com teleseminar page. If there's additional information you want to review, you can go back, listen to the recording if you need to fill in some stuff on the note takers. But again, we appreciate your time today. We appreciate everything you do. And again, hopefully you've got something from today's call. And we will have another teleseminar next month, so be on the lookout for that. And until then, thank you for what you do. Appreciate it. Don't forget to shoot me that email to get attendance. And we wish you the best. And that is all for today. So thank you. And y'all have a great day. Goodbye.
Take care. Thank you.
The organizer has disconnected. The call will now end.